30 years ago, Congress passed the Organic Foods Production Act, thereby safeguarding organic farming. But today, an estimated 80% of America's organic food is grown elsewhere. And so we wonder, did America offshore its organic farms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. I remember, way back when, how hard organic farmers and their trade groups pushed for government to safeguard their word organic. The word was the weapon small family-scale farms used to compete against the Goliaths of agriculture. Our farms are organic and yours are not, so there. Those organic farmers got their wish when Congress passed the Organic Foods Production Act of 1990. The act authorized a national organic program administered by the Agriculture Marketing Service, which is administered by the United States Department of Agriculture. The act also called for the establishment of a National Organic Standards Board to assist in the development of standards for the various substances that would be used in organic production. When the Organic Act passed Congress and was signed into law, the organic farmers were jubilant, believing they had finally safeguarded the word behind the veritable fortress of the United States government. Their industry was now free to grow. And grow it did. As a consequence of that Organic Foods Production Act, the market for organic foods boomed into a $50 billion a year industry. It's growing at the rate of 6.4% per year, which far exceeds the 1.1% growth for conventional foods. But the farmers who established that market, who built that industry, have been left in the dust, as 80% of the organic foods sold in the U.S. come from someplace else. And so we ask, did America offshore its organic farms? Who better to ask than our favorite gadfly of organic agriculture? And that, of course, would be Misha Popoff, who is the author of Is It Organic? And COVID-19 and Roundup. Misha, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Hey, good to be here, Michael. Great intro.
So, we've been working this organic subject for a while with you. How long have you been involved in organic agriculture, Misha?
Well, funny you should mention that. That year under George Bush Sr., 1990, the Organic Foods Production Act. It was about 2 years after that my family's farm converted officially to organic. And as my grandma and grandpa used to say back in those days, we were always organic. We just weren't certified. So it was really around 93, I think, we had our first paperwork showing that we were officially organic. And then I became an inspector in 1998. And it's all downhill from there.
Downhill.
But that's basically, I'm sort of synonymous with the way the regulations went, because, of course, subsequent to the OFPA in 1990, the Clinton administration started working on the National Organic Program, which was the implementation, if you will, of the OFPA. The OFPA, as you said in the intro, instructed the bureaucrats to, hey, get working on this. Come up with something that's concrete. And well, they did. By 97, 98, it was really concrete, but they couldn't get it through Congress. And so ironically, it went through Congress under George Bush Jr., who had nothing to do with it. But so there you go. The Bushes get credit on both ends, if you will, even though they didn't really care about organics at all. It's kind of an irony. But that also paralleled, as I'm saying, my history of getting into the industry.
In those days, you know, that was a great conflict between the organic and conventional farmers. And the the conventional farmers were really dismissive of the organic industry. And of course, all that's changed now because they just bought right into it and became part of it as well. But, looking back, Misha, do you recall that moment, you know, when the apple fell on your head and you realized that there's something not right with this whole program?
Yeah, I do, funny enough. So I became an inspector. I said 98, that's when I I finished my apprenticeship. I started the training in 97, but it was 2000, the year 2000. After that inspection season, I had seen things that were suspicious.
Like what?
Well, it ran in the Western Producer, which is a Western Canadian agriculture newspaper. It's still available online from the year 2000. It was a front page story. I found farmers using Roundup. And one of the things we look for as inspectors is tire tracks. Like you think inspectors that were sort of like forensic auditors, you know, but no, if there's tire tracks in a field, that probably means the field was sprayed. Now, there could be some legitimate explanations for that, but generally, any kind of farming that you do, any cultivating and seeding, there's no tire tracks left. It's that simple, really. There's a bunch of other things we do. But so the only time you see tire tracks is when someone has sprayed a field, either pre-germination or just post-germination. That's common practice in the conventional sector. Well, these guys had no tire tracks in their field. But upon walking the field, I found, like, it was weird, like thousands of footprints around dead weeds, yellowed weeds. I don't know if you know this, Michael, but when you spray something with Roundup, it doesn't just die. It gets a distinct bright yellow color just before it turns brown.
Yeah.
So yeah, that aroused my suspicions. I ended up finding the Roundup on the guy's farm. It was like in cases. So the guy, nothing happened to him. And yeah, so then later I went to the, as I say, the Western Producer. That was the year 2000. My solution was something I'm proud to say that Miles McAvoy was already thinking at the time. Miles McAvoy became Barack Obama's deputy administrator of the National Organic Program. I didn't know him in 2000. I didn't even know of him because he was still at the state level, the Washington state level. There he was trying to implement field testing. And that's what I thought, independent of him. I thought, yeah, if only I could have tested those dead yellow weeds. Mm-hmm. I could have shown there was Roundup and they didn't just die of natural causes. So then Miles McAvoy, as I say, he went on to become the BA. He tried to implement field testing. It was one of those cases where he had minimal success, and it sadly was worse than no success at all, because all he got was he got the certifiers. All the certifiers are private. We've discussed that before.
Right.
Yes. The organic farmers are supposed to be protected, as you put it, by the infrastructure of the government, but it's all farmed out. It's all subcontracted. He put in a rule that the subcontractors have to test 5% of their clients every year. That's it. And they get to choose who those clients are, the clients being the farmers or the mm-hmm. processors. So as I say, it was worse than no change at all. His heart was in the right place. And I spoke to him a couple times back then while he was DA.
So was it this issue then of testing that really turned you? Was that what?
Yeah, I did two more years after that. And then I was getting attacked basically for saying we should test organic farms. I never met a farmer who disagreed. It was always people higher up in the food chain. And yeah, basically Miles, the brick wall he ran into is what we're going to probably get to here, was the retailers, the grocery retailers.
Yeah.
They're importing food like crazy. And if there was a testing rule that say you had to test every farm, that could blow a lot of shipments of organic products from overseas.
Well, so that was where you turned and became the gadfly of organics right there.
Yeah, that's the
and,
term.
You know, you recently laid some incredible statistics on the table that would really help people come to grips with what has happened to our organic industry here in the United States. You make mention of the percentage of land that is dedicated to organic agriculture as a percentage of the whole, and it's not very big.
Correct. It's less than 1% for just easy math. It used to be when I wrote an article for the Daily Caller 4 years ago now, and it was 0.7%. And you compare that with the amount of food sales that are certified organic in like Whole Foods, Costco, and Walmart, those are the big three, it was over 4% at the time.
So and there's so there's a huge disparity there.
Huge. That's where you get the 80% that you mentioned in the intro. It has gotten worse since then, though. It's now 0.6%, down a tenth of a percent.
So we're actually losing organic farmland.
Yes, and we're having increases in organic sales as more mainstream grocers like Walmart get into it.
So let's talk about John Mackey and Whole Foods and Amazon, the big boys.
Yeah.
And isn't this endemic of the American economy as a whole?
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Whether it comes to toys for kids or clothing. I mean, clothing used to be worth something. I don't even think anyone shops at Salvation Army. When I was young, I didn't have a lot of money, so I'd go to Salvation Army. Well, you can just go to Walmart and buy a $5 shirt. It's all coming from overseas. But you're right. So this is exactly parallel to the economy as a whole. The difference is no one ever bragged that your kids' toys were made in America and supporting some, you know, some small community. So no one ever said that, even when they were made in America, right? Like Fisher-Price is an American company. And, you know, I guess they maybe traded on the fact that they were American for a while, and they certainly don't anymore because, it's all overseas. But, yeah, organic farming, of all farming, was really supposed to be domestic. That was the whole argument. It wasn't just going to be healthier food, better for the environment. It was going to help domestic farmers, family farmers.
But you made the comment in your email to me that your national standards were kind of designed to be a global in scope.
Yeah. So no one noticed that. So there we are with Clinton writing the rules, or his administration. It was Dan Glickman, his Secretary of Agriculture. And then one other guy, Siddiqui, who was his minister, I'm from Canada, his Secretary of International Trade. They hammered this out, but couldn't get it through. So Bush ends up signing it in 2001. And yeah, I don't know who we want to blame more, the Democrats or the Republicans. But yeah, this was slipped in that, and it says right there in the standard, this is a global standard. It's an international standard. And the thinking was, well, we don't grow coffee in America, so how are we going to have organic coffee? We don't grow pineapples, you know. But it turns out now, 20 years after the NOP, 30 years after the OFPA, that little phrase has been exploited. So you're getting things like flax and all your other oil seeds, like organic canola, because canola is, of course, GMO, and it's sprayed like crazy. All those things are being imported now. So then you pick up a granola bar, and, yeah, the oats.
It says made in China, but it says made in the USA, but it's really made in China. We're going to take a quick break, yeah. Misha. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Misha Popoff. And we are going after the organic industry right now. What happened to our organic farms? They're gone. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, holy folks, holy smokes, folks, the organic farming industry seems to be shrinking. Is that how you read this, Misha?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. Not only is it shrinking because of the imports, but then to compound matters, about 3 years ago, still during the tail end of the Obama administration, they approved hydroponics for organics. And the rank and file went nuts. What's left of the rank and file, you know, the domestic organic farmers.
People with soil.
Yeah, organics is all about soil. And that was even in the preamble of the OFPA and the 2001 NOP. It says that right there, but it's only in the preamble. So, you know, it's not really in the regulations. But, you know, the spirit of it is definitely included in the legislation. But, yeah, so now you'll see massive corporations. These corporations are so big, they're already buying each other out. Like Hydrobuilder Holdings has acquired Green Coast Hydroponics. I've never even heard of these guys. These are multi-million dollar deals. And what they're really focusing on is a lot of edible herbs and guess what else? Marijuana. And I used to smoke marijuana. I don't have any problem with that. Better that it's grown outside, I would say. That's really where you're going to see, I think, in other words, like three, four years ago when they passed this, allowing hydroponics, I think they were thinking that might tip the scales a bit and they could shave off that 80% import level, maybe shave it down to more like 50-50. Hasn't happened yet, but I think that's where they're heading. As I say, it sort of adds insult to injury. The big retailers are definitely importing whatever they can. Oh, and we should also talk about the organic dairy and egg industry.
Before we go there, yeah. I'd like to go back to the government because it seems to me like the plans were being laid a long time ago to export our organic farms.
I think so, yeah.
It seems like it was the government protection that the small organic farmers were seeking was actually being used to set up the globalization of the supply chain.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, it was argued that, well, we don't grow mangoes, we don't grow papaya or coffee. So everyone said, well, of course, yeah, you got to have something in there that allows for imports. But yeah, it's been exploited. And you mentioned John Mackey or McKay, or whatever you pronounce his name.
John Mackey,
he started,
I think.
Yeah, he started Whole Foods, of course. It was the largest retailer. I really think Walmart and Costco have kind of overshadowed them, but they're still certainly the sine qua non of the organic grocery business. And he did two things. Not only did he outsource a lot, getting a lot of products, like I was saying before the break, like common things like flax and canola from China or from Turkey, of all places. Not only doing that, but he also came up with the non-GMO label. And I get a lot of criticism for this. Some people try to say I'm pro-GMO. There are a couple of GMOs that I would say might work, but no, I'm definitely not pro-GMO. But in coming up with the pro-GMO label, Michael, and he really pioneered it, and he took it from just being a label to actually being a whole certification system where you pay fees to a third party, just like I used to work on contract for in the organic industry. And now you have non-GMO. Well, organic is non-GMO. And now we're seeing, because of glyphosate, Roundup, we're seeing the same thing happen again. There's going to be a non-Roundup or non-glyphosate label again. Organic is already that and so much more, or at least it's supposed to be. These things only serve to dilute what it means to be organic. So he pioneered that on his store shelves. And now someone shopping, first of all, they think everything in his store is better and wholesome. And then you get labels like natural, which are completely meaningless. Don't even go there. That's just a ripoff. And so they see non-GMO right next to an organic product. And it'll be a little cheaper because organic is harder to do. And who cares if it's non-GMO? Like popping corn. Popcorn is not being genetically modified, but they'll put it on the label. just like they put low cholesterol on things that don't even have cholesterol in them, like water. They'll actually say low cholesterol. That's a bit of a stretch, but sure. You know what I mean. Things that don't. These are labeling myths. That's the only way. And so he did that combined with his reliance on foreign products, and then he sold the whole shebang to I don't know, is he the world's richest man or the second richest? Jeff Bezos. Yeah, and now
there you go. And now Bill Gates is buying up all the farmland in the United States too. So
that's the other piece here. So in Saskatchewan, where I'm from, everyone's excited because some guy started a 40,000 acre organic farm, Michael. His name's Travis Heide. I don't wish him any ill will, but 40,000 acre farm, at bare minimum, Michael, that should be 40 family farms. Yeah. Probably 80, probably. But he's the hero now. This guy, Travis Heide, is the hero right alongside Mackey. People think they're great. They're ruining what it means to be organic. I don't wish this. He's a farmer, so I can't knock what he's doing, but we don't need more guys doing this on like 40. And yeah, Bill Gates, I guarantee you a lot of his land, he's now the largest farmland owner in America.
Second largest, I think.
Is it second? No. Maybe there's some Chinese firm that has more. Or no,
there's another media guy that's in farmland really big. But okay. Misha, let's talk a little bit about how this international organic industry works so people can come to grips with it. And we'll start with the Saskatchewan grain sale that you write about.
Oh, yes, the feed. Yeah. Yeah, so
you made mention of the animal agriculture, especially the organic dairy and organic eggs, and let's go through this so people understand how their organic food is coming to them.
Sure. So we have organic dairy and egg; those are the big ones. And there's no doubt the animals are domestic. There's no doubt about it. They're born and raised on American farms or corporate entities that look like farms on paper. But the feed, when we say 80% of our organic food is being imported, it's probably higher for feed. So there's an example from a few years ago of a Saskatchewan organic company that got into trouble with U.S. Customs. And they were trying to bring in feed corn across the border. Now, I grew up in Saskatchewan. I can tell you, we don't grow corn up in Saskatchewan. This Saskatchewan company had sourced the feed corn over in Moldova, in Russia and Kazakhstan. As it was a bunch of shipments all combined into one. Not only that, it was cracked corn. So that's what made it feed. But when corn is cracked, its shelf life is shortened.
Right.
You need a whole seed of any sort. Any seed that cracks, it starts to rot, and you can spoil the whole bunch. Well, the solution to that is to put chemicals in the corn. Now, I'm not saying they did that, but it was a shipment that contained a lot of cracked corn. And they were bringing it over from the other side of the world. They got into trouble. It was under the Obama administration still, to their credit. And U.S. Customs said, hey, whoa, what are you doing? Well, this little Saskatchewan company didn't have a lot of pull, especially with an American entity like U.S. Customs. But wouldn't you know it, their customer did. And I don't know exactly who their customer was, but it was either like Aurora Dairy or as I mentioned, the poultry egg, organic egg producers. I guarantee you, Michael, they picked up the phone. They got on the blower with whoever runs U.S. Customs, and they got the shipment through because they needed that feed. It was a ship full of feed, like thousands of tons. It was not a container. It was a whole ship. So there you go. The animals are domestic, but the feed, what makes the food, isn't. It's imported.
And of course, it's not just animal feed. It's a broad spectrum of products. One of the situations where you see a lot of that label switching going on is with honey. Honey that's been produced in China might be shipped to Singapore and then to New Zealand and then on to the U.S. and then away you go. So you really don't know. Well, wait a minute. Who inspects that food that is grown offshore in Moldova? Who is on the ground certifying that food?
Well, when I started in 97, 98, it was Americans or Canadians. And by the way, at that time, Canada was under the USDA standard because we didn't get our own standard in Canada till 2009, almost a decade later. But and even with that standard, we're still under the American standard because most of our organic products, just like most of all of our agriculture products, end up going to America. In any case, yeah, what ended up happening back then was they would ship an inspector overseas, and you had to know the language. So they were looking for, I spoke French. I only got to do a Quebec maple syrup inspections. I always dreamed of going somewhere, you know, like where they speak French, like down to Haiti. But no, there was a lot of Spanish inspectors at the time, and they would fly down to inspect, you know, coffee and pineapple. Not anymore. That's all gone by the wayside. It's too expensive. They just find inspectors in the country. So what ended up happening was the International Organic Inspectors Association, of which I used to be a member. I was a board member for 5 years. They used to be called the Independent Organic Inspectors Association. They changed the letter I from independent to international. And that was about 6 years ago they changed it. And they just started flying themselves overseas to train inspectors. And if you go on their website, they have a list of inspectors. I think last time I looked, there's 170 or maybe 200. Those are just the domestic inspectors. There's no telling how many inspectors they've trained over in Moldova, Kazakhstan, China. And yeah, they've not only then, so we're not only importing food, but we've exported the inspection of that food along with the sourcing of the food.
So it seems like when we export that talent overseas to Moldova or China or Tierra del Fuego or wherever, they're a long ways from home port, aren't they? They're a long ways from the base. And it seems like that would be an ideal setup for graft.
Yeah. Yeah, there have been American organic farmers who were ratted out by their neighbors because the neighbor saw him driving into his yard with a load of Roundup or what have you. So that's sort of, we all keep an eye on each other. We don't want to, you know, you don't want to be a snitch if your neighbor is doing something just because it bothers you. But if they're genuinely breaking the law, you're more likely to get caught here in America if you're breaking the organic law. But yeah, overseas, forget it. And remember, again, to his credit, his heart was in the right place when Miles McAvoy managed to wedge in a requirement that the private certifiers test 5% of their clients. He left it to their discretion as to who these clients will be. So
there's,
you have a certifier.
There's the opportunity.
Are they gonna collect a sample from Moldova, or are they gonna collect one from Iowa and send it to an Iowa lab? You know, the shipping will be like $10 instead of $100. And so as I said earlier, getting that it's called the 5% test rule, getting that in, I think, was actually worse, although his heart was in the right place. The other problem is he failed to get to stipulate field testing. So again, if you're a certifier, why bother getting a sample from overseas and sending it to a lab overseas? Just do it. Pick your 5% here in America. But not only that, Michael, just test end product. Why get the inspector to walk into a field and pick up leaf? Just wait till the grain is in the bin and test it. Now, the problem there is a lot of chemicals like Roundup, they dissipate. We've discussed that before. There is still Roundup in our Cheerios. It is in there, but it's going to be below such a level. The USDA standard actually stipulates a threshold level because they knew that a poor organic farmer might get spray drift from a neighbor. Sure. So they set a level that's really low. And I guarantee you, by the time, even if an organic crop was fraudulently sprayed, by the time it sits in the bin, like even just for a week or two, It's going to test below that threshold level that the USDA has.
So, Misha, why are we exporting our organic farms? Why?
Well, because it's being driven. It was so ironic. You're right in the intro, Michael. It was the farmers clamoring for a standard. Before 1990, there was a patchwork of state standards. California had the best one. It was actually recognized all throughout North America and beyond. So there were farmers outside of California who would certify to the California standard. But yeah, it was a patchwork of state and private standards. So yes, the farmers clamored for it. John Mackey didn't even have a small health food store anywhere in the 80s. I mean, there was no one else in the picture. It was just farmers. Well, they got what they wished for, and I guess they didn't read the fine print, as we've already discussed, and now it's just gone the way of everything else in America. The reason, of course, it's twofold as well, that it's harder to grow organic. So you know, if you're a retailer and you have a shelf committed to organic, you need to keep filling it. And if you can get garbage from China, you will. The other problem is land prices have skyrocketed in America.
Okay, hold that. We're going to take a quick break here, Misha. We got one more break, and then we'll pick it up when we come back. But the big question on the table is, why can't we compete in the world marketplace? Nobody grows it better. Nobody grows it cleaner. And yet, we go offshore. We're offshoring our organic agriculture. Why? There must be a reason. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour, with Misha Popoff and you, right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
We are back, and this is the Food Chain Radio program, and we're talking about our organic food. 80% of our organic food now comes from someplace else. Who's out there certifying that organic food? They're way far away from home base, don't you think? If you're, growing grain crops in China that you want to sell into the organic market in the United States, and who's certifying that? And under what kind of pressure are they in? Well, I can imagine some nightmare scenarios there. Have you ever heard of any nightmare scenarios, Misha?
Well, there's no testing on our end. See, so the certifiers are left to their own devices. They get to pick who they will test to satisfy the USDA's 5% testing rule. And there's no way they're going to test someone in China. If there's a large shipment coming in from China, this is another problem. The certifier not only charges, depending on how big the farm is and how big the production capacity is, a lot of certifiers are still charging, it's called a user fee or a management fee, but I call it a royalty. It's 1.5% of the gross revenue. So wow. If you have a million dollar shipment, or like that cracked corn shipment was probably worth at least $1 million that was coming through a Saskatchewan company from Moldova to the American livestock industry. Again, I don't know if it was dairy or egg, but in any case, they get 1.5% of the gross, not of the net or the profit. And that's why I call it a royalty. Mm-hmm. So why would they risk testing? It's going to be very inconvenient to collect a sample from China or from Moldova. And are you going to find a lab over there or send the sample over here and test it here? It doesn't make any sense. You're just going to go test the 40-acre farmer in Iowa. That's way easier. We're not testing any of it. And then our inspectors at the border, at the ports, there are USDA and customs inspectors. They do open containers if they smell something funky, you know, if it's rotting. They have the power to open any container, but they do not, none of them enforce the USDA organic standard. They're just looking for phytosanitary stuff. Occasionally they'll find food that was sprayed with an illegal chemical, a chemical that's not approved in America, and people who export to us are supposed to know that. So they look for that sort of thing. They do not enforce at our borders or at our ports. They do not enforce the USDA organic program at all. So it has to be something really egregious before customs or USDA catches it.
So the rub here is that our organic food is not tested. It's certified, which means somebody looks at the farm and says, well, okay, I certified this as organic, but it's not tested. So we really don't know for sure, except for maybe 5% of the farms are tested, but only at the discretion of the certifier. Is that correct? Let's talk about what else we consumers can do to protect ourselves. What about country of origin labeling on food?
No, that one, unless you're buying like a lamb roast from New Zealand, okay, because there's no ingredients, it's just wrapped up, and unless you're buying that, really country of origin labeling, especially in the organic industry, it has been totally gamed. So you can get around it. The example I give is certified organic, USDA certified organic concentrated apple juice coming in 60-gallon plastic jugs. And so you bring that in, you add water to it here, it's only 5% juice, or maybe if it's a higher quality product, it's only 15% juice. The rest is water. So by volume, it legally qualifies as product of the USA. And there again, also, the bottle itself is worth more than the 15% concentrated juice that went in. So these are just examples. The other example is a granola bar with flax in it. flax, you might only have 12% flax, but that's what you're paying for in the granola bar or the granola cookie or something. But the oats might be domestic, because oats are pretty cheap on the food chain, but flax is like, oh, it's easily 10 times as much per bushel, whether it's organic or not. Flax is way more expensive. So if the flax coming from China, which is only 12% of the bar, is imported, there's no law that says that has to show up. Sometimes a scrupulous, honest company will put that in the ingredients list in brackets next to the ingredient. They'll say where the sugar came from, where the granola, where the oats came from. But usually it just lists all the ingredients. If the oats were imported, sure, that granola bar company would really be forced to say, yes, this is a Chinese granola bar. But if it's the flax or the raisins or the cane sugar or what have you, these are just trace ingredients, and so they really slip under the radar.
The whole labeling thing could be gamed easily.
It is, sadly, unless you're buying a whole product, like I say, like a lamb roast or an apple. We're even importing apples. Now, the sticker on each apple should indicate that, but yeah, just the very idea of importing an apple seems counterintuitive either way. But
so that's not going to work. The country of origin labeling will not tell us much of anything, because there's lots of ways of getting around that. What about going to the government and having the government change its wicked, wicked ways with respect to this whole organic business? And bringing our farms back home.
Yeah, yeah. I'm no fan of Trump at all. Even when the going seemed good, you know, he was bringing jobs home, or so he said. And you would have thought he would have been the guy to tip the balance back. You know, at least let's get to 50-50, where we're only importing half of our organic food. But no. To answer your question. Obama let it slide, and then Trump just let it slide totally, even further thereafter. Nothing changed.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of money being made on the way things are. And when you talk about changing the way things are, you talked earlier about a company that brought in some cracked corn. And when the cracked corn was found to be unacceptable, they picked up their phone and called whoever's in charge. And they could do that because they have the economies of scale sufficient to be able to buy the government. Whereas that family organic farmer who petitioned so hard to have the name protected by the government does not have the economies of scale to be able to buy the government. And so they're out. Big fish eats little fish, right?
Exactly. And in your intro, you mentioned the NOSB, the National Organic Standards Board. That is the only hope for the American farmer to get in there. I think last I checked, there's nine-member panel, and only three of them were farmers on paper. I don't even believe those three were actual farmers, but they, at least it said, you know, so-and-so from such-and-such farms. That's always the brand name, right? You know, Wholesome Family Farms. If you copyright that name, you know, people might think you're a farmer, and maybe you were, maybe you grew up on a farm, and maybe there's some attachment to farming and some sympathy for farmers. But yeah, all nine of those people should be farmers. There's no question. There's no reason anyone else needs to be on the National Organic Standards Board. And I'll tell you why. Because the grocers, they have the National Grocers Association, don't they? And the food processors have, each state has a state food processors association, and then there's a national one, just like there's a National Farm Bureau. So those guys don't have any business being on the Organic Standards Board, but they are. So they're the ones, by the way, who got hydroponics rammed through four or five years ago.
Now, why would they have done that? Why would they have rammed through that organic standard for hydroponics?
The only way to look at it positively is that they're actually thinking, as I mentioned earlier, land prices are outrageous in America compared to China, Russia, what have you, Mexico. And it's because there's a bubble here. There's a real estate bubble, and it's just showing no signs of popping, whether you have residential, even with the lockdown. So the only good way to look at it is they were thinking, okay, it doesn't pay to run an organic farm anymore unless it's like a vertical, concentrated, high productive farm growing something like spices.
Strawberries.
Or, well, I don't even know if that one cuts it, really. It has to be something even more high value, like saffron, or like I mentioned earlier, like marijuana. I really think the corporate marijuana industry is looking to do that. But yeah, that's the only good way of looking at it. The bad way of looking at it is that they just thought, well, there are these companies coming online. I don't know, maybe they own shares in those companies and what have you. One way or another, the hydroponic industry has gone from being sort of a hobby thing where people did it on their own. It's now an industry. So they were probably knocking on the door trying to get into organics. And then there was enough people like on the NOSB who were interested in getting into it, or maybe, as I hinted, were already in it. They own shares in it. And one way or another, they got it in. And it's totally, we talk about things like GMOs and Roundup, which are horrible, but forget those. If you can throw those onto a crop if you want, if you're not farming in soil, you're not organic. You know what I mean?
Or at least that used to be the case, but is no longer the case, right? Well, you know, we've had discussions on the food chain with companies who are setting up modular vertical growing systems where they can, you know, bring it in on the back of a truck and park it right next to a grocery store's, you know, produce door. And they can literally walk out the door and harvest the food that they need and put it on the shelves and sell it. So, you know, it's a brave new world to think about that food no longer has to come from soil. But if we are going to go to Mars, we better learn how to do this right away, huh?
Mars. But you remember the movie with Matt Damon? He actually used soil when he grew those potatoes before the pod he was in blew up. But even then, yeah, he was using Martian soil. But no, I think they have figured it out. They have mastered it. And you're right. Fine French restaurants in Paris and France, they all grow their own herbs right out back. That's just sort of normal. Right. And then they get the meat and the eggs from a farm nearby. But so yeah, that's become industrialized and hyper-concentrated. So now a grocery store wouldn't just have a little thing. They could have like a five-story vertical hydroponic operation, and it rotates so you can get the stuff at the top, you know, it's ripening first, so you can hit a button and it comes down on a little elevator. And I'm not kidding, that's what they're doing. But as great as that is, you know, kind of like Tesla's electric car and his dream of building Hyperloop that'll take you from New York to LA in 45 minutes. That's all great, but it has no place in the organic industry. The foundation upon soil building is, like I was saying, Roundup is bad, but it doesn't even come close to the importance of soil building in organics.
Amen. It all starts, to get to the green, you got to go through the brown. Unless you're going hydroponically. And then you're free to do whatever you want, I guess. Well, Misha, you conclude your note to me with this incredible statement for somebody who's been in the business for as long as you have. After a lifetime in the organic industry, you write, I honestly do not see any hope for the American or Canadian organic farmer. The one thing we all thought would never go away. It was immune to outsourcing and globalization. The family farm has now been subbed out. So, no hope, Misha?
I'm sorry, but I used to tell people, so I would do an interview with you, and you'd say, wow, this doesn't sound good. And remember, 50% of organic products test positive for one or another prohibited pesticide. That was two studies done during the Obama administration.
Wait a minute. Say that again.
It's I said almost 50. It's 43%, according to two studies done. Now, they'll say immediately the threshold levels were not exceeded, but there shouldn't be any pesticide residue on organic food, even with spray drift taken into account. So, yeah, people will say to me, wow, call it half, 50%. They'll say, that's horrible. What can I do? And I would tell them, well, find a local organic farm. Well, I don't know. That was our last interview or the interview before that. I don't know of any organic farms anymore. I'm in Texas now. I used to be in Saskatchewan, as you know, but there's no organic farms around here, none. And so what you're left with is maybe a small family grower, and he's not going to bother getting certified, so you'll have to sort of decide for yourself, and that's your only hope. That last sentence you read, I don't see any way out of this. Everything's getting bigger, like you mentioned with Bill Gates buying up farmland. And that guy in Saskatchewan, Travis, whatever his name is, running 40,000 acres. I wish him the best, but there's going to be other guys like him. And that's the way it's going to go. I guess if there was 10 guys or 100 guys with 40,000 acre farms domestically, that would be better than importing. But you can see the
there it goes. You can see where you can see where this is going. But Misha, thank you so much for joining us on the Food Chain. Always appreciate your gad flying about the organic industry, because it always helps open our eyes. Folks, remember Michael Olson's third law of the Food Chain: cheap food isn't. Thank you, Misha.
Hey, thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.